USA.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This week, a remarkable moment in international justice. Slobodan Milosevic, the former president of Yugoslavia, is on trial at the International Hague Tribunal. He is charged with 66 counts of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. It is the first time a former head of state has been tried for such crimes, and it's seen as an important test case for the legitimacy and the efficacy of international justice itself. But while Milosevic sits in the dock listening to the blood-curdling case being laid out against him, many of his old cronies remain at large. Chief among them, Radovan Karadzic, former leader of the Bosnian Serbs, and Ratko Mladic, former head of the Bosnian Serb army, both indicted for genocide, though they use the term ethnic cleansing. The two are still at large, reportedly enjoying soccer games and restaurants, and none of the 30,000 NATO troops now stationed in the former Yugoslavia seem eager to go after them. Connection listener, Slobodan Milosevic is being tried for war crimes and genocide. Will this case help bring justice to the Balkans? And is putting Milosevic on the stand, individualizing guilt while many of his henchmen remain at large, is that the best way to achieve this justice? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can, of course, join us online at theconnection.org. I'm joined in the studio this hour by Dejan Anastasijević. He is a journalist with Vreme Weekly in Belgrade. He's currently a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Elizabeth Newfer is also with us. She's a journalist with the Boston Globe and author of a recent book called The Key to My Neighbor's House, Seeking Justice in Bosnia and Rwanda. She's in a studio in New York City. And Paul Williams is a professor of law and international relations at American University. He helped establish the War Crimes Tribunal. He's in a studio in Washington, D.C. Dejan, I'm going to start with you because here you are in Boston watching this remarkable moment unfold in The Hague. Your thoughts as you see Milosevic being put on the dock and having the case read against him?
We've been all waiting for this for a very, very long time, and I think it's going to be a very, very interesting trial. There is not much doubt that Mr. Milosevic will eventually be convicted. The key issue is he really going to be convicted for genocide, which is the hardest of all things, or just for the lesser war crimes that he's accused of?
Elizabeth, a lot of your work, in particular your recent book, is speaking to the victims and their aspirations for justice. Your thoughts as you see Milosevic on the stand?
Well, this is a tremendous moment for the people of Bosnia and Croatia and Kosovo to actually see Milosevic, the mastermind of ethnic cleansing, in the dock. I think, as Dejan said, this is going to be a very strong case, and the key moment will be, does Milosevic get convicted for genocide? All that said and done, there are many people who are going to feel that justice is unfulfilled until General Ratko Mladic and Radovan Karadzic indeed themselves are in the dock.
And Paul Williams, you helped set this whole thing up, the International Court. Is it doing exactly what you had anticipated years ago?
The court has finally come around to doing what we had anticipated it would do. When I was at the Department of State in 1992, then Secretary of State Eagleburg identified Milosevic as primarily responsible for the war crimes in the former Yugoslavia. 9 years later, he's finally on trial. So we're getting justice. It's a little delayed, however.
And Carlo Del Ponte, in her remarks yesterday, made a point that has been made so many times, and that is that by putting Milosevic himself on trial, the War Crimes Tribunal is specifically trying to individualize the guilt, trying to make sure that people see this as marking him, not the Serbian people, as guilty. Paul, was that part of the original intention as well?
Yeah, there are a number of original intentions, accurate historical record, victim cathartic process, but primarily individual deterrence and denying collective guilt. And this is going to be crucial because the Serbian people were certainly not complicit in the activities and the atrocities of the nationalist regime. However, to a certain extent, they were complacent. And I would be very intrigued to see how the Serbians respond to this trial and whether they begin to recognize their complacency and the fact that most of Milosevic's henchmen still continue to occupy positions of power in Serbia. And it's going to be necessary for democratic reform for that to change.
Well, I've been following as much as I could from here how this trial looks in Serbia through internet, through chat lines, through talking to my friends back home. And it's a complicated issue, really. You know, for one, Mr. Milosevic has achieved something of a celebrity status, I think, not only in Serbia, but throughout the world.
Is this a celebrity status which preceded his arrest or since he was taken to The Hague?
I think he got more of that after he was taken to The Hague. It's, brings reminiscence to O.J. Simpson. When I say celebrity, I don't mean anything positive, but people seem to be fascinated about, not only about his crimes, but also, you know, his private life. Recently, a Croatian weekly has released tapes of Milosevic's private conversations with his son, intercepted some years ago, about plastic surgery of Milosevic's son and some sort of intimate family details. And people were totally fascinated. And most media, important media, foreign media also picked that up. So this is in one way, it's a celebrity trial. Deeper than that, of course, things are getting more complicated. And I think predominant feeling in Serbia is not so much that Mr. Milosevic is innocent or guilty. Most people agree that he is guilty. But there is a problem of the hurt national pride, I think. The two people most Serbs will be asking is, one, why is Mr. Milosevic in The Hague and under trial, while his counterparts in Bosnia and Croatia, who are also not angels, and in the eyes of many Serbs, they are about as guilty as Mr. Milosevic, why are not they also standing by him? So on one hand, you have this attempt to equalize the guilt and relativize it to an extent. And the other thing is that most people would I think prefer if Mr. Milosevic, if the trial was in Belgrade.
What difference would that make?
Oh, it would make, from a Serbian perspective, a tremendous difference. People believe that people in Serbia also feel that Milosevic has done a lot of crimes against his own people, apart from doing a lot of crimes to other ethnic groups. So, you know, they believe he's our man.
Elizabeth,
and we should have a right to try him. Unfortunately, the sorry state of the Serbian judiciary at this moment simply puts this out of question, but many people still believe this.
Elizabeth, you mentioned how seeing Milosevic in the dock would mean so much to people in Bosnia and Croatia and Kosovo, but you didn't mention Serbia, and it's quite clear why. Your thoughts on just how it's going to be perceived and whether or not there'll be anything constructive come out of it regardless of the verdict?
Oh, I think there's going to be a great deal of constructive stuff that's going to come out of it, Dick. I think we're going to see sort of a period of national self-reflection inevitably, particularly as details emerge of Milosevic's complicity in various events. I think it is a time of reckoning for the Serbian people. I think it'll be a difficult time. And to a certain extent, it's going to be a time of reckoning for the Bosnian Serbs as well. What will be interesting to watch is to see how the prosecution actually handles this. Carlo Del Ponte was very careful to make the distinction between Milosevic and the Serbian people. And Jeffrey Nice, I noticed yesterday, was also very, very clever to make the point that Milosevic was not a racist in the sense of someone determined to live only with fellow Serbs, but a man concerned with the maintenance of personal power. I think the issues of maintaining personal power and corruption are ones that, Dejan, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but ones that will really ring home with the Serbian people.
Absolutely.
But Paul said also, Dejan, that the Serbian people, while they may not be complicit with Milosevic, may be accused of being complacent, of sitting back and not saying, no, we object to the way that the war is being waged in Bosnia, or we object to what's happening to the Albanians in Kosovo. What do you think about
it? It is a complicated issue. Milosevic has, throughout his rule in Serbia, one thing he was always doing, he was saying that the country that there is in danger, that Serbs in Serbia and those who live outside of Serbia border are in danger of genocide, that there are a whole lot of enemies out there, and their issues of national security have to come first. Does this sound familiar? And this was very often true. This was very often true because he was very good in creating enemies. And then, you know, any attack against Mr. Milosevic would be attack against the country. Or this is how Milosevic managed to portray this for quite a long time during his rule, until the people finally had enough. But and of course there were some Serbs who went with Milosevic all the time. But I'd like to point out a couple of things. First, there was always a resistance to Milosevic in Belgrade. There were huge demonstrations in 1991.
That's a really important point, as a matter of fact.
There were a lot of people, human rights activists, and I'm talking about local human rights activists, journalists who were fighting, some of them against Milosevic, organizing protests. Some people went to jail and took considerable risk to go against him. When Milosevic started drafting people for war in Croatia in late 1991, the response in Serbia was so low. I think it was below 15% of
available people.
Who actually wanted to go into that war, that Milosevic had to empty the jails and send violent criminals, give them uniforms and send them out to front as a part of the redemption procedure.
Yeah, but Dejan, that also worked to his advantage, as you know.
In what way, Elizabeth?
Well, because sending violent criminals, he was sending people who would be happy to become, or would be predisposed, happy.
Because decent people didn't want to go to war, they're guilty then for not going to war. No,
one of the concerns is that the and Dejan is right. The complicity stemmed from propaganda. However, unfortunately, this complacency seems to continue today. Milosevic was only reluctantly turned over to the tribunal by the Yugoslav government after the United States led an effort to threaten to cut off $2 billion of assistance. We also have to remember that the current president of Serbia is indicted by the tribunal for genocide.
Milutinovic.
Others hold parliamentary positions, and even the current president of Yugoslavia routinely denounces the tribunal.
But Paul, don't the architects of the court have something to answer for here? Because it was always thought that just taking people off and putting them in court was only part of it, that the type of outreach, the judicial outreach, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the money that would go into supporting news magazines like Vreme, hasn't been as strong as the commitment to the court, and that's part of the problem in Serbia today.
Yes, you'll find we've talked about this being a moment of reckoning for the people of Serbia, and that's true. It's also going to be a moment of reckoning for the international community, because not only has the tribunal not been actively supported by the European countries and sometimes the United States, it has been actively undermined. You know, in fact, we negotiated the Dayton Peace Accords with Milosevic in 1995, 3 years after the U.S. government had already identified him as being responsible for the crimes
Paul,
in Bosnia.
The tribunal also undermines itself. I mean, I wouldn't disagree with you there. Well, yes, exactly. One of the things that will be interesting to see is what effort the tribunal makes to actually get the word out about this case. One of the very disturbing things I discovered when I was working on my book, The Key to My Neighbor's House, was that, in fact, how few people in Bosnia actually knew about the trials that were ongoing. Even though they were available on television at that point, certainly a couple of years ago, you couldn't necessarily count on local television broadcasts to be perfectly neutral. So it'll be very interesting to see if they actually make an outreach effort, something they've failed to do in the past.
Connection listeners, your thoughts about the International Tribunal, supported by the United States financially and yet not supported diplomatically and politically, for the implications that it might have in this country? And what are the implications for the Serbian people, for the people who remain at large? Lots of questions. 1-800-423-8255 to join us. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on NPR. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon, and for the past 2 days, the case against Slobodan Milosevic has been outlined at the International War Crimes Tribunal, underway at The Hague. Likely tomorrow, Mr. Milosevic will have his first opportunity to speak back, and people speaking on his behalf say he may be talking for a number of days. He may be introducing video. He may have been planning his opportunity to speak at The Hague for some considerable time. I'm joined in the studio here by Dejan Anastasijevic. He is a journalist journalist with Vreme Weekly in Belgrade. Elizabeth Neufer is also with us. She's a correspondent with the Boston Globe and has recently written a book called The Key to My Neighbor's House, Seeking Justice in Bosnia and Rwanda. And Paul Williams is also with us. He's a professor of law and international relations at American University, helped set up the war crimes tribunal that we're discussing. Diane, I want to start with you on the one point that came up a couple of times earlier, and that is Radko Mladic, Radovan Karadzic, the two men who are seen as perhaps having the two bloodiest pairs of hands from what happened in Bosnia. They are at large.
Yes, very much so. Radko Mladic, the general, is presumed to be in Serbia. Carlo Del Ponte claims that he's in Belgrade. I believe that they may be moving him around a bit, but he's very, very likely in Serbia. And Karadzic, as far as I know, is probably still in eastern Bosnia, where he's also been moved from one safe house to another by a small detail of very loyal bodyguards.
You spent some time tracking them as an investigative reporter with
Udana. Yes, I was actually tracking Mladic was never such a big problem. Everybody knew where he was, and he even attended soccer matches and go on. He's under protection of the Yugoslav army. That is the chief problem. And the reason he enjoys this protection is not so much because the politicians are standing behind him, but because he's a soldier, an army brat, joined the army when he was 14, was always very loyal, and he enjoys, unfortunately, quite a lot of support.
It's like an honor code
military.
Among soldiers.
Yes, exactly. And this is why he still enjoys this support. And it's going to be very, very difficult to get him. Karadzic is a different matter. He is a politician. And most people, even in the Serbian part of Bosnia, see him as a crook. Because he was known, you know, to gamble hundreds and thousands of dollars during peace negotiations in Geneva, for example. He spent most of the nights in casinos and sometimes was late for conferences. He's an awful man, but he still has some support of this very rural part where he's of Bosnia, where he's signing. That people there are sort of a bit backwards, and they do support him, and he has some bodyguards who have been with him since the war. These are very well-trained, highly motivated people, and NATO seems very reluctant to go after him.
See, aside from this, you've also done investigative reporting into the war crimes, into some of the mass graves, and you and Elizabeth could perhaps be called as witnesses at the War Crimes Tribunal, no?
Well, yes, but it's up to the prosecution or defense to invite witnesses. Milosevic is in a very precarious position here because he doesn't recognize this the court. He claims it's a scam. He doesn't even want, he says it's totally illegitimate. He keeps complaining that he's been kidnapped and brought to Holland. And still, he still wants all the rights that he can get as an accused, as a defendant. So it's it seems to be a little bit controversial to me. And I think it's a problem of constant worries for the court.
Elizabeth, your thoughts on being a witness?
You know, I can't anticipate being called. And I think the question of journalists is always a tricky one. Whether or not your newspaper or your media outlet will let you testify is certainly a controversial one. But I think there are going to be better witnesses to this and better evidence. I think that Carla Del Ponte would not have moved forward to this if she didn't have a very strong set of cards in her hand. I think we're going to see very strong forensic evidence, certainly in the case of Kosovo, where, after all, war crimes investigators basically arrived on the scene very much along with the NATO troops who arrived. There is also very strong forensic evidence in Bosnia, much of which was put together for the case of General Radoslav Krstic, who, as you know, was found guilty of genocide last year for the massacres following the fall of the UN-safe area of Srebrenica. And I think we will see an effort to build on that genocide case and make a link between Krstic and Milosevic. Getting back to the point of Mladic and Karadzic that we talked about before, I'm actually more optimistic, oddly, now than I was, say, a year ago, that we might actually see the Milosevic trial build some momentum and some support to actually get Karadzic and Mladic arrested. Mladic, I agree with Dejan, is going to be very difficult. But Karadzic's support has been dwindling. And again, if this trial sheds some light on the corruption and the sort of financial rackets in which Milosevic and also Karadzic engaged in, I think people will become very, very disenchanted with him.
Let me just say, I totally agree with Elizabeth that if the prosecutor needs to rely on journalists in order to get Milosevic sentenced, that would really not be such a good. But I know that senior officials from the prosecution and senior investigators were in Belgrade for the several times for the in the past month, talking to some of the Milosevic's closest cronies, including the top officials, former officials of his notorious secret police. And I think Carlo Del Ponte may yet surprise us, because what we may see in the future months is probably some of these people who were working very close to Milosevic and who...
former deputy prime ministers, former henchmen of Milosevic appearing as witnesses.
I'm primarily talking about people from the secret police, and because this is what Milosevic always... He didn't leave much of a paper trail, I think, but he loved working through proxies, informally, and through the secret police.
Paul, just bring your legal eye to this in terms of what the parade of witnesses against Milosevic may do for the future of justice, other people who will be called. Do you see it, as Dayan's suggesting, as maybe cracking it open?
Yes, it certainly will crack it open. And my understanding is that this will, in a sense, be the first step, the first leap of the tribunal. I also have the fear that the people in Serbia and the internationals will try to make this the last step. They'll say, okay, we've prosecuted Milosevic. He was the architect. We're done. We can begin to wrap up the tribunal and move on to other issues. That would be very dangerous. This has to be the first step. We've had no meaningful reconciliation, no meaningful peace in Bosnia. A recent report indicated that there are over 75 indictable individuals who have not been indicted but who could be indicted, who exercise positions of power and influence in the local communities where they committed their war crimes six or seven years ago.
And have for some time.
You have a situation where after the Dayton Accords, Mr. Krajicnik was elected president, served as president of the post-Dayton Bosnia for 2 years, and was then indicted and arrested for genocide. With this kind of situation, you'll never have reconciliation in Bosnia, and more importantly, in Serbia. I think that the parade of witnesses will crack open the continued exercise of power by Milosevic's nationalist regime in Serbia. Right now, you have a mix of genuine democratic reformers and holdover nationalists and the Yugoslav army, and this should hopefully renew this trial, will hopefully renew the efforts of the international community and of the Serbian people to continue with their democratic and economic reforms, which are essential in order to solving this problem.
All right, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Boston now, and Andre's joining us. Hi, Andre.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Let me open with saying that as someone with a mixed East European and Russian background, I know a political short trial when I see one. The political nature of the tribunal is so transparent, it's not even funny. The clearest evidence is that the indictment was timed and tailored to the timetable of the U.S. policies in the region. Were allegations of Milosevic's war crimes in Bosnia and Croatia true, he would have been indicted in 1995 instead of rubbing elbows with U.S. politicos at the Dayton peace talks. Were Washington serious about toppling him, it could have easily done so in 1996 by supporting the Serb opposition movement Zajedno. Yet the U.S. seems to have been more interested in keeping Milosevic in power until the last part of his geopolitical agenda in the Balkans played out with the NATO occupation of Kosovo. And after the Kosovo capitulation, the U.S. had no use for him any longer. Only then the tribunal indicted him.
Okay, Dayan?
Well, I think, Andre, that you should probably make a distinction between the U.S. government and U.S. policy, and this policy has been shifting and changing in the past 10 years, and the tribunal. I can't agree that the tribunal is just an instrument of the U.S. Government. And let me just tell you, for example, when Milosevic indeed was indicted in 1999, during Kosovo War, there was actually quite a lot of resistance in Washington. He was indicted against the wishes of the administration. And you said yourself that, you know, Milosevic should have been indicted in 1995. Why he wasn't? Because there was a pressure from the Western countries not to indict him. They needed him for Dayton. So there is an interaction there. A tribunal, I think, is trying to do the best job under the circumstances. I have now. I'm sure that politicians from all sides of from all over the globe are trying and exerting some pressure. But so far, I think Tribunal has been quite defiant.
Yeah, right. Andre, you have to remember that key evidence that would come in a case like this would have to be provided by the U.S. and its allies in terms of, you know, let's say, wiretaps, intercepts. And, you know, the tribunal was totally at the mercy of getting that evidence from the Defense Department and the State Department and other places. And so Washington had to decide when it would release that evidence to the tribunal. And that may have been the key evidence the tribunal needed to go ahead with the indictment. I agree with Dayan that the policies of the two are entirely separate.
Now, it's also important to understand that there's not only the complication within the U.S. government, but also the complication with our European allies. And surprisingly, the Americans have been the most aggressive in supporting the tribunal with information and with funding. And the big mistake of American policy during the Kosovo, the Yugoslav crisis, was essentially to defer to our European allies, who at every turn have tried to minimize the impact of justice. They set up the tribunal essentially because they were forced into it by the Americans and then by the French. But after that, they implemented as many delaying mechanisms as possible, constricted its funding, and withheld information. And I was involved in both the Dayton negotiations and the Rambouillet negotiations, and the Europeans were very reluctant to even mention the authority of the tribunal and its jurisdiction in both the Dayton and in the Rambouillet Paris.
Andre, it's Dick Gordon here. I mean, if we accept that there's a lot of politics that goes into international justice, and I don't think anybody's going to quarrel with that, does it change the fact that Milosevic should, in fact, be held to account for war crimes, for what he did while he was president both of Serbia and Yugoslavia?
Yes, but you see, the individual charges against Milosevic are a double-edged sword. Every one of them could be applied to the wartime deeds of Croats and Bosnian Muslims with regard to the Serbs and each other.
But they have. Half of the indictments before the International War Crimes Tribunal are against Serbs, and the other half are against Bosnian Muslims and Croatians, and a few against the Albanians in Kosovo.
There are no indictments yet against the Albanians. Also,
there were some secret ones that they're saying that they...
Well, secret ones are a matter of speculations, because
right.
So far there are probably... what is confirmed that there are several investigations going on, but so far nobody has been indicted, at least
there's an important distinction to make here, and that is that, you know, all sides were responsible for atrocities, but it was only the Serbian government and the Croatian government which had it as a policy of their government to engage in ethnic cleansing and genocide. There's no evidence that has ever been brought forward that the Bosnian government actually had a policy or a plan. And I think that distinction is important to make, because we can't leave this thinking, well, all sides were equal, ancient ethnic hatreds, warring factions. Those are the types of arguments that were used against intervention by the UN in Bosnia and intervention by NATO in Kosovo, both of which the interventions were eventually successful.
Okay, my last question, the Bosnians, that brings me to my second point. The current war on terrorism brought to the limelight the ties between the Bosnian war effort and Osama bin Laden's network. The issue of simultaneous support from the CIA and Al-Qaeda for the Kosovo Liberation Army in the late 1990s will gain attention as well. My question is, in the context of the current war against global terrorism, shouldn't be Milosevic's legacy reexamined?
I would agree that American policy and European policy should be reexamined, because when we were faced with Milosevic, who had a genocidal plan for Greater Serbia, we refused to confront him. We tried to negotiate with him, and then we tried to allow the Bosnians to be supported by surrogates, which in this case were Iran, and in some limited instances, funds and support from Afghanistan. I think in the new terror war, it's got to be very clear that we don't engage in coercive appeasement or negotiation with those who are responsible for these crimes. We confront them head on. We've done that in Afghanistan, and I think we've been very successful to date in doing that. And that's the lesson learned. The only way you can protect and promote our interest is when someone is responsible for these types of crimes, to confront them head on, not to negotiate peace agreements with them.
All right, Andre, thank you very much for your call. Hey, Connection sure. Listeners, our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Malden now, and Irene's joining us. Hi, Irene.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'd like to point out that this is an extremely important precedent, because it will send the message to other people who have the mentality of Milosevic that they will be accountable. You know, the evidence is extremely strong in this case because the court existed prior to the atrocities in Kosovo. They will be able to prove something that nobody in the world with, you know, the right mind will ever be able to argue. And I hope that this becomes a precedent to prevent you know, such serious genocides. I really hope that other people will get the idea that they, if they are accountable, that they will think about what they're doing before they do it.
I certainly hope that you're right, Irene, but I'm afraid I'm a little bit more pessimistic. The court was established in 1994, but some of the worst war crimes in former Yugoslavia occurred after it
was
established. So Srebrenica, for example, and Kosovo, and the war crimes in Kosovo, and some other crimes also. Ethnic cleansing of Serbs from Croatia.
Now.
Oh, it is much stronger. I'm just wondering, you know, if whether it really is an efficient deterrent, and whether it's and also it's a one-time tribunal. The war just for former Yugoslavia. The wars in former Yugoslavia are now more or less over. I think we can all agree on that. And once these people are prosecuted, you know, what is going to prevent somebody in some other far corner of the world going for genocide and war crimes?
Well,
I'm not really sure it will
happen.
Irene, back to you.
Well, I think that the precedent will be set with the conviction. I don't think there's a precedent right now. We're in the process of setting the precedent. But I think after the accountability is established, that in future people will get the message that there will be somebody that will go after them, and that they will not be allowed to go about their genocides in peace. Let me put it that way.
I hope you're right.
I would agree with Irene that as Dejan mentions, it's always highly complicated. If you take the work of the tribunal, the prosecution and presumed conviction of Milosevic with the Kosovo air campaign by NATO, that's the deterrent effect. And part of the difficulty over the 10 years why the tribunal is not very effective as a deterrent was that it was undermined to a certain extent by our European allies, and there was a reluctance to use force. But if we're going to be facing individuals like Milosevic in the future, and we look at Iraq, we're very similar individual, it's going to be a combination of the mechanism of justice and the legitimate use of force. And I think that the marriage of those two elements will be a very effective deterrent in the future.
All right, Connection listeners, the question that we're posing to you this hour is whether or not the work that is going on right now at The Hague with the International Court putting its case before Slobodan Milosevic, former president of Yugoslavia, is that the message that needs to be sent to people who may be considering the same sort of activity, or is it also, as Paul is suggesting, a knowledge that the sort of force which was brought against the Taliban in Afghanistan is an equally forceful part of the message. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. We're talking about Slobodan Milosevic's appearance before the International War Crimes Tribunal taking place in The Hague. My guests are Paul Williams. He's a professor of law and international relations at American University. Elizabeth Newfer is with us. She's a Boston Globe journalist and author of The Key to My Neighbor's House, Seeking Justice in Bosnia and Rwanda. And Dejan Anastasijević, who is a journalist with Vreme Weekly in Belgrade. He's currently studying as a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, and we're going to North Ferris, Vermont. Terry's joining us. Hi, Terry.
Hi, my name is Terry Scatcherd, and I have one question. If this tribunal is successful, and I'm hoping that it is, do you think it'll change the minds of the American politicians when they vetoed that proposal of the UN to have a world court? Do you think this will change things?
Paul, that
because
sounds
I
like...
I would like to see a world court established as a permanent thing.
It won't change the view of the U.S. government on the International Criminal Court. Two important reasons. One is that the International Criminal Court would have the authority to prosecute American servicemen or others for these crimes. That's at least the view of the U.S. government. And so there's some concern that you might have a rogue prosecutor. The second important issue is that the ICC, the International Criminal Court, does not have jurisdiction over matters of terrorism. What it might, however, do is encourage this administration to work with its allies to go through the Security Council to set up a special ad hoc tribunal for terrorism to deal with these issues that we're seeing arising post-September 11. So I think the administration would be much more concerned and much more interested in mechanisms of justice if they see a successful prosecution of Milosevic. But for a variety of very complicated reasons, I think the ICC is not going to ever be viewed positively by
the American government. Doesn't the American administration get drawn into the perversity of its position supporting this tribunal but not supporting the principle of international justice, whether or not we're talking about the specifics of a court or a tribunal? I mean, we read that Milosevic wants to call former President Bill Clinton as a witness and, you know,
it's very interesting. The Americans were the driving force in setting up the Yugoslav Tribunal. They provided more funding for the Yugoslav Tribunal, the Rwanda Tribunal, than any other state.
But then we don't want to be held accountable ourselves.
Yeah, and their concern is that the rogue prosecutor, and there have been individuals who have been on the short list for the prosecutor for the ICC who've already talked about bringing Western powers to justice for what they've done in Afghanistan. And I think, you know, as one of the earlier callers mentioned, and I commented, you need this combination of the legitimate use of force and mechanism of justice. And the fear is that the way in which the ICC is constructed, you'll have justice, but you'll have a constraining impact on legitimate use of force. In fact, the Yugoslav Tribunal investigated NATO for the possibility of its commission of war crimes during its humanitarian intervention.
I'm sorry, Paul. They didn't.
They compiled a report.
They sort of looked into it and said, no, we don't want to investigate this.
Yeah.
So this was not a serious investigation. And I tend to agree that, you know, if you say that, if you press for people sending their own other sovereign countries, sending their officials to be tried by somebody by international law, you have to accept the same rules for yourself. It's either the same justice for all or not. And there are provisions in the statute in the International Criminal Court which would actually which deals with these issues. There are these problems that you are talking about, and so you know there are ways to ensure that international community can use force and not be held responsible by some rogue. There are all sorts of types of breaks you can put to avoid rogue prosecutor. I think that, you know, discarding the whole idea because somebody not mentally stable can be appointed as a prosecutor does not sound very convincing to me.
I'm not going to put Paul in the position of defending the American position, but I find it curious. I do want to ask Elizabeth to come in on part of the title of your book, Elizabeth, The Key to My Neighbor's House, is that point where you're talking about, I believe it's a Bosnian Muslim who says, I had the key to my Serbian neighbor's house and he had the key to my house and that's how we looked after each other. Is that right?
Right, that's correct. And it's a line of testimony, in fact, from one of the tribunal cases.
And when we talk about justice as the people perceive justice, how will the international court ever filter down to a level where someone living in a village knows that the neighbor went off and joined the Bosnian Serb army and resolving that kind of guilt that exists on a given block or a street or from farm to farm?
Well, here's where I think the tribunal needs to be a lot more proactive. One of the big criticisms I have of the tribunal is that it tends to exist in isolation. When you think of courts here, I used to cover the federal court in Boston, which, you know, was right downtown, and people used to come in and watch the trials, and word of the trials got out. It was part of the community. Obviously, these two, the UN War Crimes Tribunal, because it's situated in The Hague, cannot be that way. It's unfortunate that there aren't proceedings that are being held on the ground, whether in Bosnia or Serbia. It's unfortunate that the tribunal, though it has a very, very small outreach program, doesn't have a larger outreach program, doesn't work with NGOs to sort of help try and bring certain proceedings to the people, to villages, so that people can actually talk about it. One of the things that's been done for the Rwanda Tribunal is a series of documentary films have been made and actually taken village to village, because obviously in Rwanda people don't have televisions, and have allowed, you know, these have been shown and there have been discussions held about the various trials. I think that there should be a much greater effort, both by NGOs on the ground in Bosnia and the tribunal itself, to try and bring these proceedings home so people can talk about it, so they can understand how to, in a sense, get the key back to their neighbor's house.
I know, Dan, that B92 Television has broadcast foreign documentaries about what went on in Bosnia and what went on in Kosovo. That is there. It's available. People living in Serbia can see that. People also living in Serbia will know that their neighbor served in the army and now he's back and what did he do? And the justice as it exists at that level in terms of how people move past this, whether or not they...
It's a very, very complicated and very... It's very, very painful for any people in any country in the world to face the crimes committed in their name by initiated by their own government. It was difficult in Germany after the World War II, and even in one tiny village in Vietnam, in My Lai, we remember how much debate and how painful it was for Americans to face that, you know, actually there was something really, really bad occurred there. I don't want to equalize or compare, but I'm just saying how complicated it is. And to mention Germany again, 50 years of democracy and prosperity after World War II, and the debate is actually still going on, and it's not at all a closed case, even in Germany. And there were also a lot of people who want to close it for natural reasons immediately. And this war only ended 2 years ago. You know, this succession of wars in the former Yugoslavia from 1991 to Kosovo 1999, this only, and the open debate only became possible after Milosevic was put into the jail. So, and we need, you know, this debate, but it's not going to be easy. And if you expect everybody in Serbia to rise up and say, oh my God, this is totally unacceptable, and have some sort of immediate catharsis, this is not how it works. It will take, I'm afraid, years, probably decades, until this healing process is over. And this is not only Serbia, but Croatia.
But it seems, I agree with you, it will take years and decades, but it seems to me that having the debate in essence is part of the whole democratization of the country. It's an incredibly important part of both, you know, Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia moving forward. And, you know, this will be resolved, you know, in conversations over coffee and cigarettes and, you know, brandy. You know how conversations are carried out in the region, and people will debate and ask questions. I think it's incredibly important because one of the things that happened in Bosnia, or certainly, you know, the former Yugoslavia, as you well know, is that there became sort of two versions of history under Tito. There was sort of the official version. We all sort of, you know, buried.
We actually had six versions of history.
Six republics and six ethnic groups.
Yes.
And there was an official history, and then the private history that people told in the privacy of their homes. And I think the whole point of having a debate like this is that it stops those various versions from occurring, and it brings it out into the open.
And this is one area where the international community could continue to play a very crucial role. One thing they could do is set up an international truth commission, not an amnesty-based truth commission, but just a commission which tries to get one accurate historical record. And this is where I would agree with Dejan earlier's point. One of his points that he made earlier was that the tribunal has not indicted Tudjman. It was about to indict Tudjman, who was the president of Croatia, and then he died. And so the tribunal has simply said, well, obviously we can't prosecute this individual. He's dead. So the facts as they relate to the Croatian policy of ethnic cleansing and possibly genocide will never come to light through the exercise of what the tribunal is engaged in. So we need additional mechanisms. And again, that's why I say this is the first step and hopefully a long process of reconciliation. And the international community, hopefully led by the United States, is going to need to think of other types of mechanisms of justice, such as truth commissions and domestic prosecutions, which can be brought to bear on this process.
Yes, but some things should be left. I personally would not like an idea of international historical tribunal, which would then find, a given truth for everybody, because this seems like imposing of history is not a very good idea.
Yeah. Well, the model has to be a Serbian model. Whatever was done in South Africa worked for South Africa, but you can't impose that model in Serbia.
Not from the outside.
No, it would have from, to be
you can mix, help. Though. You can help people in the inside work this out, but you cannot really impose it from the outside. You can impose
strong movement for a truth commission in Serbia as well as in
Bosnia. We actually have a truth commission, which is unfortunately designed to be quite quite dysfunctional, and several people appointed there have already resigned after only a couple of weeks.
Designed by Kostunica to fail? Or,
yes,
or?
I'm afraid so. Designed by Kostunica to fail. So it's not a serious effort, I have to say. We'll have to try harder. And there are people also in other parts of former Yugoslavia who...
But, and that's why it has to be international-led, because you need a commission which has Bosnians, Croats, Kosovars, and Serbs. Every single state, former republic, has its own truth commission, whose purpose is to find out about the crimes committed against them. And so it needs to be international-led, but then, in a sense, turned over to the people of the region. But you need some type of jump-starting of that process and eventually evolve it into indigenous process. Because I think there are large segments of the population in all of those countries which are interested in finding out the truth and all elements of the truth. And the tribunal isn't going to accomplish that objective.
Well, we are 2 days into this specific trial. Let's try and look at it in the sort of perspective that Dejan was talking about, pulling the lens back. We're being told that this particular court case will last for 2 years, maybe much longer. And as it stays in the public eye, as various witnesses appear to testify against Milosevic, and as Milosevic gets to make his rebuttal, is that in some way moving in the direction that we're talking about?
Oh, absolutely. I think it is moving. I think the best way to deal with these traumas of war really is to create an open society and an open debate. But the debate was impossible while Milosevic was in power, of course, the public debate about war crimes in Serbia. Or it was possible only in a very limited surroundings. But yes, I think a lot of people will give a lot of incentive to a free and honest debate. What I'm saying is that this debate in Serbia has to be something done by Serbs themselves, not something that is just imposed on them from outside.
Elizabeth, what are we going to be saying 2 years from now?
Well, I just want to quickly get back to Dejan's point in that, you know, the famous Massachusetts expression, all politics are local. To a certain extent, justice is local, too. I think 2 years from now, we're going to be seeing a tremendous sea change in the attitudes of the Serbs and others in the region as evidence emerges in the Milosevic trial. But it will still leave many people unsatisfied. They will want to know specifically what happened in their community. I think to address that, we need, as Paul suggested, not only to see people like Karadzic and Mladic on trial in front of the tribunal, but to also think about other forms of justice, whether they're truth commissions or local courts or even discussion forums, to try and talk about and understand very much what happened in individual communities.
And Paul, you'll be watching as well.
Yeah, I think 2 years from now we'll be astounded at the fact that how it was that the United States, the United Nations, the European Union allowed this to happen over the course of the last decade. Much of the evidence that the tribunal will be presenting is evidence which would have been readily available in 93, 94, and 95. And I think that it will encourage us to be more aggressive in taking on the other Milosevic's in the international community.
Thanks to all of you for being with me.
Thank you.
Dejan Anastasijević, journalist with Vreme Weekly in Belgrade, now a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Elizabeth Neufer, the author of The Key to My Neighbor's House, Seeking Justice in Bosnia and Rwanda. She's a journalist with the Boston Globe based in New York. Paul Williams is a professor of law and international relations at American University. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.